Hi, everyone. This is Camden Busey. And before we get to today's episode, I'd like to share a word from our friends at Word and Deed Ministries, which partners with local Reformed churches around the world to meet both the physical and the spiritual needs of people in the name of Christ. Now, through more than 25 partners in 17 countries, Word and Deed supports over 50 ongoing projects around the world, Christian schools, care for vulnerable children, medical clinics, pastoral training, and so much more. And when disaster strikes, they also provide relief, helping persecuted Christians, refugees, and communities facing war, drought, or even floods. Now, by God's grace, their programs reach more than 20,000 children with the gospel, often the only place that these children hear the good news of Christ. So if you'd like to hear more and learn more and to make a difference, visit wordanddeed.org. And don't miss their special Giving Hope gift catalog in our upcoming Reformed Forum magazine. This is a wonderful way for you to bless those in need this season. wordanddeed.org. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 934, if I've got my numbers in order. My name is Camden Busey. I am the director, executive director of Reformed Forum, as you know, and host of this podcast for 18 years. We've been going at it for a long time, and I'm excited to be back with another episode. I'm in the headquarters in our podcast studio in Libertyville, Illinois. And recently, I returned from Powder Springs, Georgia, where I attended the Reformation and Worship Conference at Midway PCA. We had a great time at this event, which is organized by David Hall and Terry Johnson and their respective teams. It's a wonderful conference, a wonderful group of people. We loved being there. There's so much overlap between the things we love and care about and the community here at Reformed Forum and the people that love attending the Reformation Worship Conference. I really felt at home there, and I was delighted to record three episodes. The first one, I spoke with Carlton Wynn and Mark Harrington. And the second one, I spoke with Jonathan Master. And in this episode, I'm bringing to you a conversation with Chad Van Dixhorn. We talk about the Westminster Assembly, about consensus, about compromise. We spoke about doctrinal preaching. It was a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it on a fine Saturday morning with him at this conference. So I hope you enjoy it as well. Before I take you over to that recording, to that conversation, head on over to reformedforum.org. There's been a lot of stuff going on. So you're going to find a whole host of new books in our store online. Subscribe to our email newsletter. When you do so, you're going to be enrolled automatically in a mailing list for our biannual magazine, and we have that due very soon. So it's going to be hitting mailboxes soon. So we want you to get subscribed. If you have a U.S. mailing address, we'll send you a print copy for free twice per year. And if you do not have a U.S. address, you'll still get a digital copy emailed to you as being a subscriber to our email newsletter. So visit reformedforum.org/newsletter to make sure you stay in touch with us and stay connected, because that's the best way for you to find out all the wonderful things we have going on. New publications, new courses, new podcast episodes, new events. There's a million things going on, and we've got a great year lined up for us in 2026. You're not going to want to miss anything. reformforum.org/newsletter. I do want also for you to stay around and listen now to this conversation I had with Dr. Chad Van Dixhorn. Well, we're back here in the library at Midway PCA during the Reformation and Worship Conference, and now I am here with Dr. Chad Van Dixhorn, an old friend, an OPC brother, and he serves right now teaching as a professor at RTS in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome, Chad. It's good to see you again.
It's great to see you again, Cam.
Yeah, we've been having a good time, and I've been introduced to a dear family friends of yours, and we've been having a great time, even staying at the same place for a couple days. And finally able now to catch up and speak a bit about your work. You've been speaking here at this conference, doing several sessions, circling around topics that are of key interest to the people that come to this conference, but doing so from the vantage point of your expertise on the Westminster Assembly. I'd love if you maybe talk just about your history and past at this conference and of the brothers here. You can let us know. How long have you been coming?
Boy, I was told last night that maybe my first time was 2017.
Okay.
And this is a wonderful conference, the the Midway Reformation Conference. It's a great time for fellowship. Lots of thoughtful papers.
Yeah.
Good preaching, worship. So it's a feast for the soul, for the heart, the mind. So glad to be here. Thankful for David Hall and the many others who make this possible.
It's nice to come. I've mentioned before, but when we go to lots of events, conferences are all have their they all have their different ethos or character. But sometimes when you're on the road doing exhibits and you're going to one thing after another and it's a lot of presentations, it's nice here to also have the worship services.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need rest for the weary soul and to hear a good word preached from a very capable minister and to sing songs with enthusiasm with many other like-minded believers. It's a true joy, and you don't get that in a lot of places.
So. Yeah.
Well, you were speaking, at least in the first address that I attended, it was a couple days ago. Or was it just yesterday morning? I think it was yesterday morning.
It was just yesterday. Yeah. Seems like a lot's happened.
A lot has happened. But you're speaking particularly about the Westminster Assembly and the different dynamics involved in producing our standards, thinking of compromise and collaboration, and all involved in the formation of the confession specifically, but also the larger and the shorter catechism. I'm sure you get prompted with different thoughts about that. And what are some perhaps typical examples, or at least ways people interpret that, thinking, well, the standards are a consensus document, or they are a compromise document? What are some applications, right or wrong, that people might draw from that fact?
So I suppose three things come to mind. First, the process by which the assembly went about its work was one of cooperation and collaboration, but they weren't really trying to build a consensus. They weren't looking to consistently, at least, come to a unanimous mind. There's no way of doing that with so many people in the room, with so many different perspectives. So I'd say that the process is more one of collaboration rather than consensus. And then when I think about the final products, sometimes they're referred to as a sort of consensus documents, perhaps even more sloppily. Sometimes they're referred to as compromise documents. I'd say they're documents with compromises rather than compromise documents.
Yeah.
They're documents that have lots of points of consensus, but they're not consensus documents on the whole. And then the third thing, when we look at the sort of the final steps in which the assembly took to kind of decide to send these away and kind of put the baby on the bus and wave goodbye. I think it's best to think of that last process as a kind of a corporate confirmation. The assembly wasn't looking for sort of for personal customization of all these documents. And I just think those three things are helpful. So that was a bit of a ramble.
No, I appreciate that. And it's useful to be reminded of those things. I remember even prior to coming to seminary, I was still reading Reformed works and thinking, and I didn't understand much about the Westminster Assembly. I wasn't catechized growing up, but I just assumed that if one of these divines had a view, then that must be a perfectly fine and normal Reformed view. And then I came to realize, well, there were people at the assembly that had views maybe of justification, imputation, all sorts of things. I'm thinking of guys even like Thomas Gadiger, I think, might be a good example.
And they
weren't able to get the standards necessarily to say what they wanted.
Yeah.
And that isn't always a bad thing. I think over, you know, the whole process and in the Lord's providence, the documents that were produced are not, I appreciate that, not compromised, or they're not properly, perfectly a consensus document, but by the way that things were produced end up being sound and solid and useful for the church for centuries.
Yeah. So just thinking about to run with that, thinking about the process of writing, drafting, debating these documents, it's collaborative in the sense that everybody can be involved.
Yeah.
Lots of people were involved. when a committee came with a new proposed sentence or idea or paragraph, those who disagreed on the committee mm-hmm. and were not supportive of that sort of majority suggestion to the assembly were given their own voice. Mm-hmm. So there's this collaboration that everybody's involved in all sorts of different ways at every stage of the document. And yet there's these sort of two kind of equal and opposite mm-hmm. Statements that need to be made. The first is they just looked for a simple majority for every statement that the assembly approved, just a bare majority. On the other hand, they almost always had unanimity, or at least the room had enough consensus. The collaborative process went well enough that there are actually surprisingly few votes. So if you look at the highly complicated minutes of the assembly, when you see ordered, it just means that the prolocutor kind of looked around the room and said,
anyone have a problem with this?
Yeah.
That's how my session works.
This is where we are. We've kind of read the room. The debate has fizzled. Yeah. A majority has formed. I'm just going to order it. Nobody protests. Resolved means they had to vote. Yeah. Resolved with numbers means, okay, they actually had to count the votes.
Yeah,
it was that.
Close.
It was either that important or that close.
Yeah.
Occasionally, someone registers a dissent. It's very, very rare. Mm. And so you've got these kind of gradations.
Yeah.
So you can look at the feisty debates and say, wow, there's a lot of disagreement. Yeah. But a lot of guys just stayed silent and allowed the people who disagreed with the committee to have their say, the people who supported the committee to respond. But most of them are just watching what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the prolocutor looks around the room mm-hmm. and says, okay, everybody's had their say, we're ready.
I like that.
And there's surprisingly few votes uh-huh. on these documents. So
a couple questions on this, maybe not related. It's on the point of what we're talking about, but while we've got you, you know, this is what we do here. We take the conversation where it goes, and it's better for it. I'd love to know just a general assessment of the personalities. I mean, were these generally an agreeable bunch? And beyond that, was that typical of the time, of the culture, or is it unique to the divines?
Mm-hmm.
But even before that, in whatever order you would like, I'd wonder if you might share an example of the very rare dissents. Like, what would be a good representative example, and why might that have been such a point that it happened?
Yeah. So four quick things. First, just to back up, the reason why I care about the process is because sometimes people say there's lots of disagreement at Westminster Assembly.
Yeah.
We ought to be able to have equal amounts of disagreement in our church.
Yes.
Well, we join voluntarily, even in the OPC.
Yeah.
They didn't join the assembly voluntarily. Yeah. They were commanded to come. So it's not a good analogy.
And commanded not to come.
Yeah. And then people who did come, the king told them not to come. When you look at the people who came, they're all post-Reformation Reformed divines, but it's actually an event like the assembly that helps bring them to a similar mind. Mm. It's not like people disagreed and stayed disagreed. You actually see minds being formed, people being shaped. Reformed theology at a major event like this where people can talk about and share their ideas, there's actually a process that's happening in the clarification of Reformed theology. And the kinds of men who are there are for the most part humble enough to be part of that, and to be corrected, or to have one's opinion or conviction set aside in favor of someone else's or the majority's.
Mm.
There's this when I was going through the minutes again and again, George Gillespie, Scottish commissioner, Philip Nye, outspoken Congregationalist, would refer to one another as reverend. The reverend commissioner says, the reverend brother says, and I took that on my first, second, third, fourth, fifth reads for the minutes each time to be sarcastic. And then eventually I thought, why have this jaded look? Why have this jaded perspective? These two guys are really disagreeing with each other. This isn't sarcasm. They are taking extra steps to be especially respectful to the people they most disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a different paradigm. And suddenly I thought, well, this is kind of impressive.
Mm.
And then I began to look for like really outspoken, irritated comments. There is one where Joshua Hoyle calls his old teacher, Thomas Gadamer's views, a heresy. There is a moment when someone accuses the other of popery. And that happens during the theological debates, not elsewhere. But it's really rare. And they apologize. So the overall spirit is, you know, it's something like, I think it's probably more like a Banner of Truth conference with debates.
Yeah.
Then it is like a political environment with a lot of heat and anger.
Wow.
Was that really four things? In my own mind, that was four things. But
we're going to say it was.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. So you can listen to other episodes we've done in the past covering the history of the assembly for an overview. And Chad, of course, is written on the subject and spoken about the subject in many other places. But one thing you mentioned in this address was also speaking of our standards, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechisms, as even having different products in different parts. I think they're not all uniform, and they might have different attention. They might have different style, different intended purposes. I'm wondering if you might share that with the listeners and speak to that.
Yeah. So
the analogy of the vehicles.
This kind of falls under the bucket of a document with consensus rather than a consensus document. There are times when they're saying, how many different shades of opinion can we get on board here? And there's times when they're saying, we really want to exclude a lot of error here, including views of particular people who are present. Mm. So when it comes to the chapter on justification, Thomas Gadamer's views are excluded. The prolocutor's views, William Twiss's, are excluded. There are careful paragraphs that would deny the idea that we're justified in eternity. There's a paragraph that says justification is not just the forgiveness of sins, right? Mm-hmm. It's also the imputation of Christ's righteousness. It's an umbrella term for two distinct benefits. Well, Thomas Gadamer and others denied that. And there are paragraphs that are excluding the views of people further away, Roman Catholics, Arminians, and so on. The way I see the chapters of the confession, they're like different vehicles in a kind of presidential motorcade. You could have a chapter like chapter 12 on adoption. That's the open top convertible. Mm-hmm. There's no defense against error in that chapter at all. Any sort of deviant view of adoption is the chapter is completely unprotected from any such assault.
Mm-hmm.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, chapter 11 on justification or chapter 29 on the Lord's Supper, these are more like armored vehicles. Mm. They're heavily plated. They've got a turret, you know, on top to kind of, you know, they blast away certain errors as well as defend from certain errors. They're lumbering vehicles meant to protect the church from common errors. And then I think most of the chapters are this third sort of genre. They're they're like the limousines with bulletproof glass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not impregnable.
Right.
They're meant to have a degree of – this might be a stretch, but there's meant to be a degree of elegance here, of readability. Presentation matters. It's not the open-top convertible, but it's not the armored vehicle
the lumbering
either.
Vehicle, right?
And so there's times when a chapter could have been more – you know, they could have added the additional armor plating of extra adjectives, qualifying phrases, and so on. But they get heavier and clunkier.
Mm-hmm.
And the uninitiated would begin to say, like, what's this mean? Mm-hmm. It would become actually less clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cost of the extra armor plating would make the entire confession just a heavier document.
That's an interesting point, and we hear this sometimes. I work a lot and serve in an ecumenical environment, a Reformed ecumenical environment, especially at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, and in the Midwest where I'm at, there's a good and healthy presence of continental believers, and their confessional tradition is often older and different, sometimes maybe serving different purposes, and sometimes written by a single author rather than written by a whole assembly. You and I are convicted Presbyterians. Like, we are aware of these groups. We work alongside them. We love Reformed Ecumenism, but we're both convicted Presbyterians for a reason. Yep. And actually love our standards. And personally, I think you would agree, I don't want to speak for you, but think that
they're,
they're more theologically sound, partly because we're standing on the shoulders of giants at the time, but we're being older or newer or later. There's more reflection. There's more precision. There's all this. And I'm sure you've heard, and you get the jokes and the barbs sometimes of the people saying, you Westminster guys like all this, but it doesn't speak. It's cold. Yeah. It doesn't speak to the heart. You know, I love the Heidelberg Catechism because it's tone. And I love the Heidelberg too.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you might just compare and contrast, not line by line, but in terms of what we're talking here with the process is very different from from the way that the Heidelberg Catechism was formed and who wrote it and why.
Yeah. Two main thoughts. Yeah. The first is that when we're looking at confessional standards, we're not asking the question, how would I write this if this was my own personal statement of faith, my own personal systematic theology? As much as we might like to do something different, it's not about personal customization. It's about corporate adoption. And so we need to think about that with a level of humility. Those who have an instinct to defend every single statement in the confession as though it were the best possible statement are making an error. That's not actually what we're asked to do. And those who want to continuously revise the Westminster Standards because they have a new idea or their seminary does, or we all do, that the constant customization doesn't help the church either, because then the statement may, the confession, for example, may be a little bit more crisp. Mm-hmm. It may be a little bit more full, but then we lose the systematic theological tinkering can thwart the other purpose of a doctrinal standard, which is a kind of ecumenical purpose. The document is meant not just to state doctrine, but over time, in fact, initially, right away, this document was meant to unify Scots, Irish, and English. Over time, it's done much more than that. There's people all around the world, and people for 350, 375 years have been using these documents. So they have kind of an ecumenical purpose. Mm-hmm. We see, other people have that confession, and they hold it. They don't just have it, they hold it. We can say, well, I wonder what work we can do with them. Mm-hmm. But the more we begin to tinker and so on, the harder it is to do that cooperative work. The harder it is to see that we belong in a longer and deeper Christian tradition. It's point number one. Mm-hmm. Point number two, briefer. The larger and shorter catechisms do still often state truth in the third person, but they begin to incorporate a lot of second person and first person language. That there are statements about how do we benefit, what do we believe, and so on. But I don't want to defend the Westminster Standards vis-a-vis the Heidelberg Catechism by principally saying, well, they've got a little bit of that in it. I want to say, actually, in our own day, there's a lot of churches, a lot of people who love to talk about what theology means to them. Mm-hmm. They want to say what I believe. And that's good. We need to know what we believe. But it's actually also really important to say, what does God say? Mm-hmm. And so I think actually, especially in our own day, when so many people have a subjective form of religion, an objective statement about what's true and not simply what I believe has heightened value. Mm. And I don't want to miss that. So I'm not really apologizing for the third person objective statements. No. I'm actually saying that has a unique value in our own day.
Yeah, and we can be maximalists too, we can find great use in the Heidelberg Catechism and other catechisms and resources. And I tend to try to be a maximalist on these things whenever possible.
But I think you can be, Camden, or a seminary faculty can be. yeah. sort of six forms of unity people yeah. in a way that's actually counterproductive for a church.
Yeah.
You know, when the PCUSA was going liberal.
Oh, I don't think we could run a church
yeah.
like this.
Yeah.
I would struggle yeah. if we were to unite with the URCNA, which I would love in some regards. Yeah. I think it would be yeah. perhaps unmanageable.
Yeah. Yeah, because liberals know that there's a more is less yeah. principle. Yeah. Yeah. If you have so many documents yeah. that you subscribe to, you begin to subscribe to an abstraction. Because
uh-huh.
the average minister, ruling elder, deacon right. just cannot kind of right. keep all that together. You can, because this is your business as a theologian.
right.
But, you know, when there's new churches forming, they're sometimes yeah. saying, let's be six forms of unity, people.
And the RCNZ, I'm aware. Like, yeah. the churches yeah. do this. Yeah. Very good, yeah. faithful churches yeah. do this. Yeah. I'm just speaking of.
But it's hard.
Yeah. Yes.
It's hard,
sure.
yeah.
Well, I spoke a few weeks ago, a month ago, with one of your colleagues,
yeah.
Blair Smith.
Yeah, Blair
and
Smith.
He's recently written and published a book on Reformed Confessionalism.
Yeah.
He had many great points in that book, and I enjoyed speaking with him about it and reading the book. I was benefited by it. But one really interesting point that has stuck with me there is he speaks and he encourages and counsels the church not to be seeking to revise the confessions or to be writing new ones frequently. Mm-hmm. You've heard that in the past. People say we should always be writing a new creed or a new mm-hmm. confession. He suggests we don't do that, and he thinks that perhaps is better served by writing systematic theologies. Mm-hmm. Like the discipline of writing systematic theologies are taking these truths, exegeting and then organizing things topically, doing systematic theology, dogmatics for whatever context we're in. So we can, and he thinks that's a better approach to doing what some people might want to do by writing new creeds and confessions. And then the reason is we have pretty darn good creeds and confessions.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't need to throw them out. We need to stand upon them. And
yeah.
If for some reason we find that something's wrong, then maybe... Yeah. The odds of that are pretty minuscule, in my opinion. But if that becomes the case, then yes, then let's think about maybe adjusting them.
Yeah.
But let's not scrap them and rework them over and over and come up with a new creed or confession each and every generation.
Yeah.
How would you distinguish those two? I mean, do you think along those lines and
yeah.
thinking about the work of the systematician, the dogmatician in relation
yeah.
to
yeah.
the function of these other documents?
I think that's yeah. very thoughtful, very yeah. helpful. And, you know, again, in terms of not continuously revising or in terms of wanting to update, I think the vintage of these documents is actually a benefit. It, mm-hmm. it reminds Christians who are always riding the latest wave that, you know, Christianity was not actually, you know, invented during the Reagan administration. We have an old faith, and having old documents reminds us of that. We have a Reformation faith, having Reformation documents reminds of that. We have documents that carefully include ecumenical phrasing and ideas from the early church where truths were hammered out with great difficulty. Again, I'm not a big fan of reinventing the wheel. I like what Blair says,
mm-hmm.
Where we want a creative and productive outlet for growing. Let's invest in reading and writing systematic theology, biblical theology. You know, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
And where there's a wide consensus across Reformed and Presbyterian denominations that there really is something crucial that's lacking,
mm-hmm.
Then let's address that. But let's not just address that as private communions, as one church yeah. here, one church there.
Yeah.
Let's do something that has a real cooperative flavor to it.
Let me ask you, because you've been in part of study committees, and you've helped write study committee reports. You were involved in the one in 2016 that was received in 2016 on republication
yeah.
in the OPC. How do you see the role of a study committee report? I mean, other churches have read ours and taken it and appreciated
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
These are not things that are confessionally binding
yeah.
upon the church,
yeah.
our officers in our polity, and other people aren't incorporating them, I don't think, into their confessions.
Yeah.
But yet there's still a great importance to say that we have elected several men through a determined and a proper process to work on something for us as a church. and to help us understand this particular issue. It's, we've done many of them over the years. What do you see the role of a study committee report in relation to individuals doing systematic theology or historical theology and versus a council or an assembly
doing this? I think the role is extremely modest in comparison. I do think that a good committee report will often be referred to. It's surprising how often these committee reports do get referred to by theologians and by churches. So I think
I'm still pulling some up from the 40s when talking to guys about lodge membership and stuff.
So the OPC, the PCA, and other churches have just done great
reports.
Free
offer the gospel.
So I find them very useful. I myself cite them, read them, review them. My own experience has been one of growth, being in a committee like that, in dialogue. It was like a six-man committee of the Westminster Assembly, except we weren't trying to write something. We weren't trying to come up with new theology. We were trying to understand what the Bible teaches, what our standards say. That was enriching for me. I had a lot to learn about our standards, about the scriptures. So it's a privilege to serve,
right?
But I give it a pretty modest role in the big picture.
But what do you think that role is in the big picture? Do you think it's calming people down when we're on a, you know, is it just doing some legwork and some heavy lifting so the whole body doesn't have to do it itself? That's great value. It is modest, and it's not the same thing as either. But there might be a way we could say I think you can make a case that a well done, well timed study committee report could be quite a bit more important than some guy writing a systematic theology.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the point is always much more narrow.
Yes,
so
that's true.
It might be more important than a chapter in a systematic theology. Yeah. What's interesting is that it remains kind of one of the rare venues in the theological world where a bunch of people are really trying to get on the same page exactly, as close as they can. You know, in a multi-author book, 10 people, 20 people can all approach the topic from their own personal angle. There's still the personal statements angle when you're writing when someone's editing a book with multiple authors contributing on the same theme. Or there's just a single person writing an essay or a monograph. Here you're actually trying to get a bunch of people to agree about sentences and paragraphs and ideas.
Yeah.
There aren't many parallels. Right. And so that's something that the church endeavors to do, that the academy rarely endeavors to do, that individuals rarely endeavor to do. So that's what's, I think, particularly unique. There's a sharpening that happens when you have to get on the same page as people, or
you don't
as much
have
as
to.
Possible. Right. You can,
But it's insane. You're always pushing it. How much can I push this without forcing a minority report?
Yes. Yes.
Because we don't want that.
It's a bit of an epic fail to have a six-man committee and produce six reports. Right. Right. So one hopes that doesn't
it
happen.
Happens. Yeah. Well, I still have you for a couple more minutes. I do want to ask about doctrinal preaching
in
Westminster Standards. There was another address that you gave here.
Yeah.
Speak to that. What? How do you define doctrinal preaching, and how do you approach that through the lens of the Westminster Assembly?
Yeah, no fancy definition. I think of doctrinal preaching as an attempt to arrange theological topics, perhaps the minister's own arrangement, where he deals with, you know, doctrine of God or some aspect of the doctrine of God, and then scripture or the decrees or whatever it might be, or doctrinal preaching can follow a preset template, the Apostles' Creed, the Heidelberg Catechism, and so on. The question is often asked, given that there were Westminster divines who preached through, say, the Apostles' Creed, did they just sort of forget to add Lord's Day breaks in the larger catechism? Did they mean for that document to be preached? The answer is no, they didn't mean for that to be preached. The Directory for Public Worship instructs ministers to preach from the scriptures. In the debates of the assembly, they determined that one ought not to preach sort of from a principle or from a statement. You need to preach from the scriptures. So that's not to say that some divines themselves did not preach catechetical sermons or doctrinal sermons, but the assembly as a whole does not endorse the practice. They do, however, oh, by the way, those who do preach catechetical sermons did not always do so by choice, because afternoon sermons were forbidden in the 1630s, but catechism was allowed. And so Puritan ministers would fudge by preaching catechetical sermons during the catechism hour. But they did believe in doctrinal preaching in the sense that many of them would use William Perkins's model of exegesis of a passage, followed by the identification of a doctrine or doctrines, and then the uses of those doctrines, and then the applications of those doctrines. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sermon based on a passage, but the center of it, the main reference point, is the doctrine. And some of them did that really well.
Yeah.
And some of them would sometimes give you a sermon on Romans 9 that would not really in the end tell you a lot about Romans 9, but would tell you a lot about election. Mm-hmm. So some liked that. Some did it in such a way as to explicate both scripture and doctrine. And some really just gave you the doctrine. Mm-hmm. There's a variety of what Puritans did, a variety regarding what Westminster Divines did, as there's a variety in what Reformed ministers today do.
Sure. And clearly in the URCNA and in the continental tradition, it's very common and even required to be doing catechetical preaching in a second service.
Yeah.
But they're even there and within there and in the OPC, you know, our pastor preached through some of the standards, the catechism. And,
But
it can be approached very differently.
Yes,
people
it can
have
be.
Much different opinions and thoughts about this. And, you know, I'm wondering if you might share some thoughts about how to approach that or whether someone should.
Yeah. Well, I do have my thoughts or opinions.
as much as you're willing to share.
Yeah, right. So I grew up in a church, a faithful church that had Heidelberg sermons in the evening. Even as a child, I sometimes thought, well, it looks like the Heidelberg Catechism is the text and the Bible is illustrating the Heidelberg Catechism. And I thought this, you know, I don't even know that I was a believer, but I thought this has to be a little bit upside down. Now, that's not how everybody does it. Some people clearly preach a text and then they bring in the Heidelberg Catechism, but many literally preached the Catechism. And at that point, God's word is serving as illustration or support for a man-made document, a beautiful man-made document. That strikes me as problematic. I think we need to avoid that. But I also became convinced over time, listening to Heidelberg, looking back on those experiences, I began to wonder, Camden, if the evening mode of preaching was impacting the morning preaching as well. And so the morning sermon was a straight up, served neat, exegetical sermon. And yet the minister very quickly tried to extract a doctrine from the passage and preach the doctrine in many instances. So some preached the scriptures, and I remember how vivid that was. You know, the text of the Bible was coming alive to me. You could hold open your Bible and you're understanding Matthew chapter 1 better and not just the incarnation better. Yeah. It's very important to understand the incarnation.
Amen. Right.
But the incarnation is presented in Matthew 1 in its own unique shape and
form. It's a record of God's redemptive activity.
Yes.
His events.
Yes.
History.
And so I think that for decades, maybe centuries, there has been a sort of a slice of the Reformed world that has approached the exegetical endeavor in order to find a doctrine. Yeah. They don't linger in the text.
Yeah.
One gets to know the text through a lifetime of sermons, but it's a slower go, and one gets to know doctrine better than the Bible. So that's my concern. If it's going to be done, it has to be done right. I've not usually seen it done well. I know there are counterexamples.
Yes, of course.
And counterarguments.
Yes.
Such as, but what do you do about a church that's doctrinally ignorant? And we do need to make sure we're getting kind of well-rounded. The whole counsel of God needs to be delivered to our people. And the attraction of the catechism sermon is that it organizes it for you.
Yeah. And I've been on a couple different sides of this issue over the years, and my thoughts are still a little bit fluid. I am firmly convicted that if I were to do it, I have not, but if I were to do it, I would certainly look for the text and just preach the text. And that's my biggest concern, is the first one you raised. But also, I think in the other regard with the doctrinal style preaching, I wonder, it's just harder sometimes for people to exegete and preach the text than it is to formulate a quick, effectively a homiletically informed Sunday school lesson. And that's not exactly preaching in the sense of proclamation. It's it's more communication of information. And that's not, if we really boil it down, it's not properly preaching. It's not a sermon. It's something else.
It's a lecture in sermonic form. And we must proclaim the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
We must teach doctrine. Mm-hmm. Let's not confuse the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe last question, and just asking you, tossing this out there, I'm not prompting you. This might totally go over like a lead balloon. But is there anything in
a Led Zeppelin even?
Yes. Is there any? I like that guy. I was talking to somebody once, and I don't know, Pink Floyd came up. They're like, "Who's that guy?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's not a guy." But is there anything in particular you're excited about or encouraged about in your field, or just in, you know, Reformed confessionalism in general? I mean, what really is getting you out of bed in the morning? That you're really excited that's happening, or that you're excited to be part of, or that you're looking forward to?
Yeah. Those really are two different questions. Yeah. What I'm excited about in the Reformed world is the publication and translation of works by Westminster Divines. So 21 volumes of Rutherford, 4 of those volumes from the Latin, mm-hmm. fantastic translations, great introductions. That's in progress. The works of Anthony Burgess.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. Works, sort of signally important works by various divines. Oliver Bowles's pastoral theology. David Noe should have a draft of that translation by December or January.
David, do you hear that?
Anthony Tuckney's systematic treatises gathered together are being translated by an Englishman named Simon Hitchens, beautiful mm-hmm. translator. So these works are coming out. That's really fantastic. I'm glad to be part of that team. I'm also really excited about the work that John Bauer does in terms of just giving us the history behind our standards and then kind of capturing the birth of these texts. Chris Coldwell has done a great job of capturing the life of these texts, right? How have they changed and been used over the years? Bauer's capturing the birth. You know, what was, by comparing these manuscripts and texts right down to the sort of the commas, if you will, he's kind of getting us back to what the original proof texts were. And so on. He's doing a great job. I'm really excited about that. I'm writing a history of the Westminster Assembly. I do enjoy doing that.
Mm-hmm.
None of those things get me out of bed in the morning.
Gotcha.
Because writing is harder than teaching.
It is.
You know, so the joy of the Christian life and ministry, and the privilege of teaching at Reformed Theological Seminary with as good of a crop of students
mm-hmm.
As I've ever seen, godly,
mm-hmm.
hardworking, and thoughtful. That's really great.
Praise the Lord.
So,
well, we look forward to the things ahead, and we'll continue to keep you and your family in prayer, and we're very thankful for you, brother, and I'm thankful for your work, and I hope the Lord continues to provide the opportunity for you to do more and more of it, because we're benefiting greatly. So thanks for taking the time here in my office away from home.
Thank you, and I'm grateful for Reform Forum. I'm a fan and a follower.
Well, we appreciate it. Thanks, brother. Thank you so much for watching this episode. I hope you enjoyed that conversation from the Reformation and Worship Conference, which was hosted at Midway PCA in Powder Springs, Georgia. We really enjoyed being there, and I enjoyed the conversations I had while I was there. Just as a reminder, go on to reformforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our news, updates, programs, books, events, everything that we have going on. We'd love to stay in touch with you. You can subscribe to our email newsletter. You can also send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org. But I do want to thank everybody for watching and for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.